At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
On a give for the all-time leading rusher for the Niners. Stephon Gore cuts it inside. Frank Gore is still going. Touchdown, San Francisco!
Two from the 40, couple of tight ends, receiver right, and Adrian. Handoff, Adrian. Scoots loose up the middle, across the 30, to the 20, inside the 10, touchdown!
First down at 10, Johnson gets a shoulder square! Watch out! He's got getting away from the top speed! Touchdown!
Welcome in to Grinding the Edge, episode number 65 here on South Harmon. I'm your host, Koopa, and you can find me on X at Dynasty Koopa and everywhere else at Koopa Troopa 8. Since I know this may be some people's first time here, I want to call out that you should go visit southharmonff.com. If you've never gone there before, there's a bunch of tools on that website that either I or other people at the South Harmon community have created. There are things that I talk about a lot, things that are referenced not only in the South Harmon community, but ones that are referenced in various forms outside of the South Harmon community. Personally, I have made the Warp tool and simulator that you can find under the Warp Worshipper subscription on the website. If you've never tried it out before, you can use the code INTERVIEW in order to get 1 free month of the tool. So go to southharmonff.com. and use the code INTERVIEW to get 1 free month of the Warp Tool and Simulator. This week, I had the pleasure of interviewing Tommy Blair. If you've never listened to his podcast, The Superflex Super Show, you need to go check it out. He and John, or the Superflex dude, both go through some absolutely amazing strategies in how they play fantasy football to take advantage of their league mates. And Tommy specifically has some very off-the-wall strategies that we touch on briefly here in this interview, but you absolutely have to go listen to his podcast to find out from him just how he goes ahead and implements some of these strategies. If you are looking for someone who plays the antithesis to a lot of the strategies that we talk about using in our own communities, then you have to go take his podcast to listen and figure out what he and John are doing on a regular basis, because these strategies have really opened up my mind to how not only I can play, but how I need to play differently and how to recognize when somebody is doing a strategy to take advantage of me being in my league. So with that, let's get into the interview. So, Tommy, I obviously have just introduced you here, but I don't know everything that Tommy Blair is up to. I only know what you've been doing in the past. Where are you right now, and what can I find you doing here in the future?
Yeah, first, thanks for having me on, man. I listen to your show literally every episode that comes out. I'm like waiting to hear what Coop has been up to. So I'm pretty excited to catch up with you to share some of my thoughts. But you can find me over on the Superflex Super Show, one of the DLF podcasts. I'm over on Blue Sky at FF Tommy B. Kind of laying low this non-point scoring season, not guesting on a ton of shows, just like doing my thing, hanging out with the family. We're actually about to head over to France here in just a couple days. So it was just serendipitous that you and I could catch up. Over on the Superflex Super Show, though, we're talking a lot of strategy right now. We're digging into, yes, the numbers like you are, but really trying to understand a little bit more what's going on in startups, because it feels like startup season right now. Right before we get into the actionability, you know, like this time of year, training camps are going to kick off here in just a few weeks. It feels kind of like you need to pick a direction in what you're doing. And so we're trying to set directions for the Super Friends. We're trying to figure out, you know, some of these adopted teams. What are we doing to sort of like get alignment before the craziness happens? And I really like it. This time of year is like one of my favorites, because you get to make big moves. You get to make big swings. You get to pick what you want to do sort of with these big shifts, these trades that we're making, these decisions that we're making. And I don't know about you, man, like that really, like it sets a course for my teams that reverberates for the next 8 months. You know, like the choices we make today are the choices that we're going to have to live with over the next 8 months and beyond.
For sure. Yeah. Setting up your teams this time of year, you're choosing your direction if you are choosing one right now. And it, the point that you're at, like it in July, if you're choosing a direction one way or another, you are probably stuck with that, except for a scramble mode to try to fix it when you get to like October. But otherwise, you're basically choosing for the next 4 months, what am I doing with this team?
Yeah. And I think it's a good time of year to do that. I admire folks who have the patience to wait until like week three or whatever. But I've found that like, if I'm the first to the water bowl of whichever direction I choose, compete, rebuild, collect all of the draft picks in 27, find all the quarterbacks, you know, become a robust RB guy because you think that that's the way that the NFL is going to support. I've found that like, if I head there first, trades are more likely to get done, right? Because other people haven't picked that market clean. But B, I've found that like, I'm more pure in my decision-making process. And I find a lot of value in that. I don't know about you, Koopa, but like half measures do not work for me in fantasy football. Go all in with your best ideas, as my co-host John likes to say. I find a lot of value in that. I find that when I do that, those are teams that I pay attention to. Those are teams that tend to be a little bit more different than my league mates. And I think it's really cool when you find those edges in the market of being different and doing it earlier than everyone else.
I always want to be in a situation where I have done something to the extreme so much, it's either going to work out, I'm winning a championship, or I'm falling flat on my face. And it's like, man, this team earned somebody the 103 and I don't have my picks for the next 2 years and something like that. But if I have a team that ends up earning the 108 at the end of the year, I'm sitting there looking at that just like, what did I do? I obviously didn't pay attention. I didn't do enough in this league in order to get something fixed here, because being in that middle is just not where I want to be.
How do you know it's enough, though? It's always challenging this time of year to know what enough looks like. We're going to talk about individual strategies, I'm sure, but like beyond strategy, let's set that aside, because every strategy has pros and cons. Where do you, Koopa, feel like I've done enough? You know, it's July, it's August, whatever. Like, I've set my direction. I've made those big bets. How do you know that, like, I don't need to push a little further? Is it just you've exhausted all of the resources that you deem less important, or you've accumulated all of the assets that you feel like really matter in that type of build? Like, talk me through that a little bit.
For me, it's mostly when I look at my team, I can say I know what every single asset's role is, and I don't feel like I need to move any of them to get something where I need to move a piece in order to get something else at this moment in time.
Yeah.
Now, it might be that, hey, because I had this on a few teams last year where I had my 25 first still hanging around, and the goal was not, hey, I need to get this 25 first in order to bolster this team right now. Like, I felt like the team was in a good spot already, but I had a role designated where, like, I don't know what you do, but I keep an Excel spreadsheet with all my leagues in it, and I put notes next to each one if there's something specific I want to remember about that league. And so with a few of them, it was 25 first for a wide receiver upgrade or a wide receiver replacement come week 10. And that's just what I wrote down. So that way I have the role for that pick. Now, with most of those, yeah, that's where it ended up being. I would either upgrade it at that position or maybe upgrade somewhere else, depending on where the value kind of fell to. Some of them I needed to pivot a little earlier than that. Some of them I didn't even end up actually spending it in week 10 because just the value wasn't there. It didn't end up working out that way. But I had a role for every single asset. Whether it was that first round pick, whether it was every single player, there wasn't somebody where I was like, hey, this guy is here and, you know, they've got a lot of dynasty value, but I'm not really selling them. And it's just like, if I have nobody where I'm like, I don't know what to do with this, then that's a team that is in the position I want it to be in.
How many are leading men? How many are carrying that role in your builds? And like, can we break this down a little bit? I don't want to sidetrack us too much, but I think this is really important and fascinating stuff. Again, strategy aside, like building those roles, they're asymmetrical, aren't they? There's leading characters in your builds. And for me, there's a lot of like extras, like not even supporting characters, folks who don't get lines in this movie, so to speak, like players that at best we'll see one, maybe two spot starts. That's still a role, but that's just filling in the gaps for the rest of my team, really running through some gravitational force or pivot point or something that is honed in. It is the reason that these teams exist, right? Like, is that how you're considering these roles, or are they maybe a little bit more numbers based? Are they like you're focused on this individual asset or these very few individual assets?
So the role doesn't have to be, hey, thinking about it as this player is playing this role specifically. The way I look at it is I need a group of players to play this role. And so that might be, hey, I'm trying to fill that quarterback two spot, and I'm trying to do it with players who are off the waiver wire. And so the whole reason for me going through that series of podcasts that I did back, I think it was in January, where I went through how many backups I need at each position in order to be comfortable filling that spot. So if it's, hey, I need 10 backup quarterbacks in order to fill my QB2 spot, if I'm sitting there and I can go, I have 10 backup quarterbacks on this roster, then I know, okay, I'm feeling good. All 10 of these quarterbacks, you could look at it as individually, they are one of the 10. I look at it as I have these 10 quarterbacks playing one role. And that's how I look at my team. And so anytime I'm looking at the other players, if I was doing, say, the Scott Connor traditional roster construction, where he has 7 wide receivers, I would be looking at it as, do I have 7 wide receivers who are part of the group that I would feel confident in starting? And so then, as long as I have those 7, all 7 of those guys are playing that role. But if I have an 8th wide receiver that I think is good, and who I think could be part of somebody else's 7, that is now somebody that is without a role on my team, because I am larger than the number that I'm targeting.
That's really interesting. I find myself just sort of offhand saying when someone's like, oh, tell me about your team, I'll say like, okay, I've got Josh Allen, I've got Jalen Hurts, I've got Patrick Mahomes, Justin Jefferson, I've got 6 wide receivers behind him and 30 running backs, whatever, you know, like that's just an example mm-hmm. built. When the names start to matter, when you're naming the players, those are the pivotal pieces where it's like the strategy has to become somebody, right? Like at the very top of these warp curves, they have to be a person. And then when you get down the warp curves a little ways, they don't. There are a lot of people, right? And I think that is the game. That is the strategy game that I certainly try to play. And I think you do to a certain degree as well, is like, how few names can I make matter while still having the same impact? And where can I minimize my bets, right? Like we all have to make bets in fantasy football. Sometimes we get lucky. Sometimes we're able to like sharpshoot these things. There's only one Justin Jefferson in the game. There's only one Ja'Marr Chase in the game. There's only one Jalen Hurts. There's a lot of RB30s. You know, like, it doesn't really matter who they are, you know? And I think that we lose that at times as fantasy analysts when we're trying to pick these names out of those tiers. And we can almost remind ourselves this time of year, like, it doesn't matter. 10. You want 10 of those. Any 10 works, you know?
And I think I will counter that a little bit in terms of the way I look at the top end is that we don't know exactly who's going to finish as quarterback one, wide receiver one, running back one. And so I still lump a lot of those guys together. For me, it's not, I want Justin Jefferson. I want one of the top grouping of wide receivers, which realistically is Jefferson, Chase, Neighbors, CeeDee Lamb. Maybe based on your opinion, Amon-Ra might be in there as well. But I'm looking for one of those guys. If I'm saying I want one of the top wide receivers, if I want a top quarterback, I'm looking at the grouping of Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Jaden Daniels, and Jalen Hurts. I don't care which of the four I end up with. To me, and how I look at my construction, all four of those guys are the same. Now, if you talk to anybody, and even me, like, who's has a better chance of finishing as the quarterback one at the end of the year? Yeah, Jalen Hurts is probably the lowest on that list. But I also think that Jalen Hurts has the potential to be up there trading blows with those guys. And so I'm going to group it all together. If I'm just needing to get one of that caliber of quarterback, then that is, he's one of the people that I'm willing to target, but I'm going to target whichever one I'm able to get. I'm not going to be biased where, like, I'm just going to keep pestering that Josh Allen manager because I want the number one overall quarterback. That doesn't make a difference to me. Give me one of the top four guys, because on a year-to-year basis, any one of them could move up and down that slight grouping there.
That's so portfolio of you. And I appreciate it. I genuinely do. And also struggle so much because we as dynasty analysts are tasked with giving the capital V answer to the big problems. The big problems being who is going to finish number one overall at quarterback, running back, and wide receiver, lesser so tight end, unless you're in a heavy premium. That's the real duty of fantasy analysts, is to predict the future in an unpredictable set of data. And it's such a challenge. It's an impossible task by and large. And your measured approach is probably the right one. And yet when we get to August, I certainly get DMs of, well, who out of those top five quarterbacks is going to finish as the number one overall? And it is kind of on us, isn't it? To like provide a name. Eventually you do have to provide a name. Because those are decisions that people are going to make when they have the 101 in their redraft leagues, or if they're going to be drafting Scott Fishbowl here in a couple weeks. Like, eventually you got to pick somebody, you know, we have to, we don't have a choice. The theoretical component of this fades away unless you're in 40, 100 leagues, something like that.
I think what's interesting is kind of how I compare myself to a lot of different analysts. Like, I was talking to you pre-show about, hey, what do I view my podcast as? And I view my podcast as being able to say, hey, here's some data to be able to help you out in terms of making sure that you aren't doing something totally wrong, but also encouraging you to come up with your own strategy, something that fits with you specifically. And for me, I am not a good football analyst. Like, I know that. Like, I probably am better than the average person sitting on their couch, but in terms of me compared to anybody else that actually does, like, fantasy projections over the course of the year, that spends a lot of time looking into player stats and things like that, you should listen to them, because that's exactly how I make my own personal rankings. And so when, if somebody comes to me with a player question, I am only giving an opinion of, hey, I would choose this person over this person because they're two different kinds. If you came to me and you said, hey, should I take Jefferson, Chase, or Malik Neighbors as my first wide receiver on my team this year? I'd be like, you can't go wrong with any of them. And I think being okay with saying that as your answer, and then also knowing that your audience is going to accept that as their answer, is a very unique position to be in as a fantasy analyst because of, as you said, everyone just wants the answer.
Yeah.
And my goal is not to give anyone the answer. I don't want anyone to have the answer. I want them to have the right questions to ask themselves to come up with their own.
What's going unsaid in the Jefferson Chase or Neighbors conversation is you're going to be wrong 2 out of 3 times. Somebody is going to finish higher, even if it's incrementally, right? And it's probably not going to be incremental. There is very likely to be one dominant wide receiver, because there usually is one dominant wide receiver. It may not be those three, right? But there is going to be a number one overall finisher, and they're going to have an outlier experience this year. And you're going to be along for that ride. And can we parse through that and pick a favorite of the three? Absolutely. When you were talking, I was struck by sort of the thought process of a energy manager, of a building scientist. We take these theories, these principles, these laws of physics. And that's sort of what you're providing on a very fundamental sense, Koopa, is here's the information. Here are the sort of the expectations of this reality that we occupy, this non-physical world, which is fantasy football. What you do with it is an applied science, right? Sometimes it's an art, sometimes it's like jazz, you know, you're taking structure and you're bending it in creative ways. But that's the role of the fantasy football player, is to rely on folks like yourself, very smart people who can give you information. And it's up to you how you manipulate, how you optimize, how you bring efficiency into the way that you play. And conversely, how you can disrupt the efficiencies of your league mates.
For sure. So what I want to do is get a little bit into what is, we've talked about kind of my strategy here of being so player agnostic of a portfolio. And the way you said that was kind of like, man, that's so portfolio of you. I could never do that. So what does the Tommy Blair strategy look like?
So if I were playing fantasy football, if I were an analyst 15 years ago, I think I would focus on efficiency, optimization, finding the best odds and pursuing them. And I think that works in a lot of ways in today's dynasty game. However, there are tools, there are more voices that are analytically driven, there's more wisdom in this space. And I think that as the sort of typical fantasy football player, the dynasty players that we're running against in our own leagues, as they get smarter, as they get wiser, as they have more resources available to them, there are diminishing returns to being an efficient, optimal player. I've found that a lot of managers who I've played with for the past 5 or 6 years, they've gotten better. And the strategies that they've adopted all kind of look the same, right? I'm seeing slightly higher preference towards backup running backs. I'm seeing more backup quarterbacks being rostered, a devaluation of tight end. I'm still not seeing necessarily lower numbers of rostership at wide receiver. And I'm really intrigued by that. That feels like the next domino to fall in terms of optimization. But as I play with different managers who are doing these strategies that are, yes, very basic, but they're also really effective, right? Like if everybody plays with an optimal roster construction to the settings, well, what do you do next? And so when you understand efficiency intimately, it is important to then start to learn, how can I destabilize these economies? How can I covertly trip up the managers in my leagues? How can I use their own efficiencies against them? I'm an energy manager by trade. Like I work on optimization, on efficiency, on making things work as smoothly as possible with all sorts of unpredictable inputs. That's very similar to the dynasty space, right? Like we don't know who's going to get hurt. We don't know who's going to underperform. We don't know, you know, which receiver is going to lose their passer for 8 weeks, for a year, whatever. Like we don't know who's going to get traded. Like these things we can't predict. They're out of our control. And so I feel that becoming more flexible in this efficient space and finding where people maybe lack the experience or the intuition or the understanding of the next step of what to do once they've optimized their roster construction is the next leading edge in fantasy football. Understanding that if I can put this one stick between the spokes of whatever bicycle is rolling forward, they're not going to be able to recover. And all you have to do is trip up a manager once, and their whole roster build starts to unravel, I've found. And once you get those people on their heels, then you can either go back into efficiency or you can affect an unregulated market in really interesting ways. And that's really where I've found the most success, is not necessarily being efficient, but being intentionally inefficient, which is a challenge to do. I've found that I get really negative feedback. I don't know what feedback you get, Koopa, but I get fairly negative feedback from folks who don't listen to my stuff regularly. They say, like, this can't work. And I found that's just a lack of curiosity or understanding or maybe experience in implementing these maybe more fringe strategies. And once they do, they start to see, oh, I understand how this works now. Instead of X, we're doing Y, and it leads to, you know, this different outcome that is more impactful or equally impactful, but we're just doing things in a different way. And I think that that is where the next dynasty managers are going to really start to make advances in the space.
Do you see that in terms of what you're targeting as those different efficiencies that you'd say, putting that spoke in the wheel? Yeah. Is that something, how often does what that spoke is change? Like which wheel it is that you're targeting, which strategies it is that you're tripping up those managers on? What does that cycle look like?
It is wildly differing. I could be playing the same 11 other managers in 100 different leagues, and there's a surprising lack of consistency. And so it takes a lot of work to trip these other managers up, right? Like you have to sort of cultivate the right situations. You have to understand that, you know, I'm just going to use you as an example, Koopa. This may or may not be true, right? So let's say that, you know, you are somebody who rosters two good quarterbacks and a bunch of backup quarterbacks behind. I think it's a fairly common strategy, right? Well, what happens if both of your quarterbacks go down, right? Like, I think that that is a reasonable question for somebody implementing that strategy. Do you have an answer for what you would do if you lost both of your quarterbacks and the rest of your team was relatively on track or healthy?
Honestly, in most of those leagues, I would just bail.
You would just bail.
I take the rest of that team because when I'm looking at those quarterbacks, when you say good quarterback to me, that means one of those top four guys.
Yep.
Maybe include Joe Burrow in there as well. All of those guys, I can be like, I can re-roll them next year. Like, I just keep them on my roster. So if two of those guys went down, I'm just going to take everything else off to contenders. You get shipped. I'm bailing on this year and come back next year with hopefully another round that doesn't get hit by the same issue.
And so what does that do for the rest of your roster, right? Like, I think that that is another next step that you need to take. If you understand that, you know, a Koopa-type manager who has this type of quarterback room, are you rostering running backs at volume? I would imagine so. What do those running backs do on your teams?
And usually what it is I have that running back I have a second running back slot. It's pick one of those guys. They're supposed to go into that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm filling on my team. In the situation where those quarterbacks have gone down and I have all these running backs built on this team now, I'm shopping every single week. Whoever it is that I would be putting in my running back two spot is trying to get shopped to somebody else, and I'm trying to convince them that they want this guy in their flex.
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of ways to go about this. Like, I also roster a ton of running backs. I would say close to 65% of my roster is running backs across my entire portfolio. So if I'm in a super flex league that's like, I don't know, start two running backs, three wide receivers, a tight end, and a bunch of flexes, I might have three wide receivers. I might have four. I very rarely have five. And so if you're adding up, you know, four quarterbacks, let's say one tight end and three wide receivers, that's a lot of running backs, right? So I think I could probably compete with you in that market. And so if I knew that Koopa had lost his quarterbacks, he's going to be on a fire sale. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sell lower than you. I'm going to beat you to market. I'm going to try to bludgeon you and freeze 10, 15 running backs onto a team that they can't move. Not because, you know, there's any other intention other than if you and I are rostering 30 running backs in total and I can freeze out your market, those players don't exist in that universe anymore. And so what does that do? It makes third string running backs much more important. Fourth string running backs much more important. If I'm selling significantly cheaper than you running backs that should be for seconds, I'm selling them for, you know, a 2028 third, you know, I'm undercutting you in every single step of the way. I'm able to pick up players and lock your market up, right? So you've got two quarterbacks who one is good, one is hurt. Your running backs are stuck and I've created a different market than you at 15, 20, 30 running backs with these very like low wide receiver rostership builds. I can still hold course, right? I can essentially remove you from the rebuilding market and become a more active trade partner with these other managers. It's very little things like that of just knowing the tendencies of when things go wrong with other managers, how you can make sure that they are less successful with what they do. And what that's going to do moving forward, if you're paying attention, you're going to say, well, this just doesn't work if I'm rebuilding. Maybe I need to rethink how many running backs I'm going to roster in this league because the market is soft. I'm not getting the returns that I want and the liquidity isn't happening, right? Like I'm not able to churn when things go wrong. So this is only a winning strategy if I'm winning. Like that would potentially open up more access to me to running backs in 2026 and 2027.
Yeah, for sure. And so one thing I was thinking about when you were talking through all that as well is we're talking all this in the perspective of lineup. Yes. And when you were commenting, hey, like 65% of my portfolio is running backs, it might be that 65% of my portfolio is wide receivers.
Yep.
Because I play in so many best ball leagues. What does your portfolio look like in terms of lineup versus best ball? And do you have anything that you do differently depending on your different formats that you're in?
So I think you're accomplishing essentially the same thing that I am, right? Like we're using different positions, but for the same purpose. That's my understanding, at least. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't play a lot of best ball. I don't like the format. I don't want to shame anybody who plays it because I think there's a lot of fun to be had. It doesn't support who I am as a person and what I try to accomplish. And I think that that's a really big part of having fun in fantasy football that goes underrated is understanding who you are and what it is you're trying to get out of the game. We all want to win. Like that can be set aside. What do you actually want to get out of the game? How do you want to play? And I think the format can help support that. For me, it's not best ball. I've tried it. I've done okay at it. Like I haven't won more or less in that format. I just don't like my teams because they look and act in ways that I don't enjoy. And I can't affect my league mates in the same manner because we're exposing ourselves very intentionally to variance. And we're using that as a tool as opposed to the decisions that we make on a weekly basis. Is that your experience with best ball? Is like, talk me through how you manage, like, actively co-pilot with variance in best ball versus lineups.
The way I utilize that variance, and this is probably what you don't like about it, is the variance is the strategy.
Yes.
The strategy is I know that I'm not going to make a decision on who's to start this week, because if I just throw enough players at the wall, somebody's going to come out with something good this week.
Yes.
At a greater than 90% rate or greater than 80% rate or whatever it is. And I might even get lucky. And at the right moment in time, when we get to, you know, like week 16, I'll have six guys and I throw and two of them hit instead of just one. And all of a sudden now my team has gotten a boost just off of that pure luck factor of how many guys I'm throwing at the wall. And what I find rewarding, and this is maybe in terms of me, how I like to play, how I am as a person, I very much like when the little thing works out really well. And so there's one team where I will always go back to in terms of the perfect example of this. 2023 championship week. How many people even knew who Bo Melton was before Bo Melton went out there and he caught however many bajillion passes for 100-something yards and two touchdowns? on championship week. Not many people did. But I was one of those people that I had gone out and every single team that was still competing for a championship, I had recognized like 2 weeks prior. This Bo Melton guy, he has opportunity here. There could be the potential for him to come out and do something great. And sure enough, I hit on that. The odds were low that it was specifically Bo Melton. But in terms of how I build my best ball teams, it wasn't just Bo Melton that I was in on. I was in on probably like 10 or 15 guys. The league that I'm specifically referencing to, it was one that the startup had happened earlier that year. And my first 9 picks, 8 of them were running backs. Because of that market inefficiency thing that we've kind of been touching on here of taking advantage of your league mates and understanding, hey, what should I do in this league? I just dominated every single top tier running back.
Yep.
And my top wide receiver going into the season and when I got to that championship game was Jacoby Myers. I had nobody better. And I needed to start 4 wide receivers every single week. And so think about who was probably behind Jacoby Myers every single week. Nobody that you really knew. But to me, I prefer to win off of that Bo Melton performance. I prefer to win off of the random 4th wide receiver who all of a sudden they get the opportunity to be the starter for this week. And they come out of nowhere and they have their blow-up game of 4 receptions for 75 yards and a touchdown because the defense doesn't take them seriously. And it's that kind of thing that that's what I want. That's how I want to win. I want to win getting those little tiny edges, finding the random guy, and having them prop up my team.
I'm glad you brought up Bo Melton because I told my friends this in 2023. He might be the best wide receiver that nobody's ever heard of. Like, he does not play very much NFL football, but he's legitimately like a good football player. You look at his underlying metrics from that year in 2023. So he participated in 40% of the routes. Like, he needed to double that to be a real relevant wide receiver. But you look at things like his yards per route run. He was over 3 yards per route run, which is like Tyreek Hill level stuff, like crazy efficiency. You look at his first read target share, 15%, first downs per route run, 0.188. Again, like, these are incredible numbers on very low volume. I think that if you are to expand out lineup leagues to be, you know, start 16 or something like that, that's where you sort of get this blend of the two, of the best ball and the lineup decision-making process, where Bo Melton's become legitimate. And that's the type of format that I really like to play, is the start a bunch of people where you're really having to grind through the very bottom. And I do find my most success at running back. I'm not going to lie there. I'm not going to roster Bo Melton probably unless it's that type of format. Or the extremely shallow leagues. I know people shit on like a 23-man start 9 dynasty superflex league. Those are so fun, Koopa, because what happens? Waivers are so rich, right? And you can rebuild in a season because those waivers create all sorts of opportunities to fall backward into great players or to churn your roster over to where, you know, you look back a year or two, guess what? You only have 2 players from that roster in 2023, 2024. Like, you've turned over your whole team in a year or two and you're competitive again. And so you're asking me, like, which format do I like? I like the extremes. I like having really, really shallow benches or really, really deep benches where we have to start actual dart throws, like players that Bo Melton's, people we've invested in, you know? That's a really fun component of Dynasty as well.
Yeah. And so kind of moving on from this, but still staying in the same realm, like you've mentioned that you're an energy manager. And how does that, the philosophy of what you do with work, what it is that you do in your normal daily life outside of fantasy football, how does that creep in to your fantasy football strategy and the decisions that you're making just at a subconscious level?
I think it goes beyond subconscious. I think it's a very conscious, intentional process to incorporate my real life. And it's something I think everybody should do. I think everybody has superpowers in their daily life that they can bring into this game. Not in the way of like, if you want to be an astronaut, you can be an astronaut or president or whatever. I mean, today you may be able to be president, who knows? But there are superhero type skills that everybody brings to the table, and yet they tie their arm behind their back when they come into a game like this because they don't think whatever they do applies, right? Like, I used to be a very competitive athlete, and so I have a deeper understanding, I think, than the average NFL fan of what it takes to train to the degree that these people do, to be injured, to recover from injuries. I've suffered some really horrific athletic injuries. And so I understand the recovery timeline of a compound fracture or a torn Achilles. Like, I've been through it. I know what it's like to be in a room of like elite athletes and how that sort of affects your mentality. And how difficult it is to be in that environment day after day, year after year. It's not an easy task just to exist in that environment. And then moving into the professional world, you know, I've been a baker, I've been a pool boy, I've been a crepe maker, I've run daycare centers. I've been able to experience all sorts of different things. And I like to draw on all of that, because it's all relevant. We're playing, yes, a numbers game fundamentally, but anybody can understand numbers if they get enough access to these different tools. It's what you do with those numbers to affect the human component of the game, where you can become not just a good player, but a great fantasy football player. And so that's what I do. I really try to intimately understand numbers, and then I try to see where people might misunderstand them. Because when I'm giving presentations to folks who are working for utilities, I come at it with the assumption that they don't understand the numbers that they've given me. And so I make sure that we're all on like a very even playing field when I'm presenting information or things that I think we should be doing to optimize their, you know, their grid on, you know, over in Wilmington, North Carolina, because they've got a nuclear plant, they've got a lot of solar, they've got a little bit of grid resiliency issues. And so I make sure that we understand this information before we start going forward with the recommendations. In fantasy football, you don't have to do that. You don't have to make sure that everyone understands the same information. And so it's about identifying where misconceptions may lie. And you can't do that unless you really intimately understand data and efficiency. So I think that's where I draw from real life, is understanding the athletic components of it, and then pairing that with the numbers.
Now, something else that you've been open about in some of your podcasts as well is your experience with therapy.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, has the experience of going through therapy, learning all the things that you do about yourself in therapy, changed anything in terms of how you approach the game of fantasy football?
Oh, 100%. I think it's a great question, because anyone who's gone to therapy, I think we'll be nodding along when they hear that, like, a lot of therapy for me, at least, is about discovering preconceived notions that were inaccurate or biased in problematic ways, right? So we learn how to cope in our daily lives with loss, with trauma, the stresses of work or parenting, when a partner cheats on you, or, you know, there's a million different things. And we are not, as people, just inherently given all of the tools to deal with those things, right? Like, we don't come out of the box just sort of ready to cope with whatever society gives us or whatever situations we put ourselves in. And so what do? We become calloused, and we find a workaround in our daily lives. And it's not like we forget about those problems that have happened or the consequences of those problems. We just learn to cope with them. When there could be healthier coping mechanisms, there could be more effective coping mechanisms. And so me personally, when I go to therapy and I have one of these breakthroughs, it's a relief. It's an easing of this like heavy weight that I've been carrying, this complicated process that I've been subconsciously doing on a daily basis, right? And when you're freed up to not have to do that anymore, you can choose to. Right? That choice of, using those coping skills that you've gained is incredibly empowering. You've also gained efficiencies. And so when you have efficiencies to no longer, I don't know, drink your way through a problem, let's say, you get better rest, right? Your body feels better. You're less prone to depression, right? So there's all these other extra bonuses that you have, and it creates greater capacities. And with those capacities, for me, it's led to a lot more curiosity. And I found that to be like one of the biggest benefits is when I go through therapy, when I see the work that has been done over years, months, you know, whatever, I've found that my mind is more open to the gray areas of life, the different perspectives of life. And I find myself looking up at, you know, things like trees and starting to understand them better, you know, all of the systems in place there. And I start to be more present with my kids, and I can see another human being working through their own challenges, right? My therapist has this phrase that he brings up pretty consistently of our lived experience. If we think of it like a projector, you know, on a wall, very often what happens is we tilt our projector onto others and we expect them to see the same thing. But what they end up seeing is their own projection and ours overlaid on top. And it leads to all sorts of confusing outcomes, right? Understanding that our projector is our own and being able to sit with that and have it stay where it is while also seeing another person's screen is a really, really cool thing. And that's what happens when you do therapy, in my opinion, is you gain that extra capacity.
For sure. I haven't talked about it as much, but you know, some of those same things that you talked about is some of the stuff that I've gone through as well. And understanding, like when you talk to those league mates, like for me, the hardest thing was being told no.
Yes.
And once you get past the fact that like, hey, if I send a trade offer and they're just outright reject it and you can just not care, you just be like, okay, I guess they didn't want to do it. It lowers that barrier of even just sending out those trade offers, doing the things that you need to do initially just to get yourself where you need to be. Or this is the first off season that I've really looked at some of my leagues and been like, why am I in this league? There's yes. Nobody's active. I don't care about anyone in this league. Like, it's just hard to really get anything done. Like, I'll just orphan this team. And I'm one of those nicer managers in terms of like when I'm orphaning a team, I'll be like, hey, you want me to pay year ahead? Or like if I think it's in a bad spot, I'll definitely be like, hey, I'll pay ahead for you. So that way somebody gets a free year to deal with this thing. So you don't have to worry about it. But it's being able to look at not only just in life about like, hey, I can go out there and I can do things without the fear of rejection, but then seeing that how it applies in the fantasy space, I think it gives an additional perspective that in addition to just, hey, it's better for my fantasy teams, it allows you to see progress in a different way in yourself.
Yeah. You can reframe it a little bit too and say, all right, so as a man, as a white man, I have been taught consciously, subconsciously that being rejected is a bad thing, that failing is a bad thing, that it speaks somehow poorly about who I am, like my character, my willingness to like see things through, to stick it through, to be like a John Wayne type, or maybe I'm unskilled, you know, like maybe I'm just not good at this. That's not what rejection is at all. It's a momentary no. It's something not happening just for that moment. And practicing at failure in fantasy football, I would argue, is a great thing. The way that I overcome it is I don't read feedback from others very intentionally. I don't want to hear any of the negative feedback. You already gave me enough with the no, with the email that I get at the sleeper notification. It's like, oh, okay, that deal is not happening. But I think by practicing at failing, like you said, it opens up all sorts of avenues. I'm an ultra marathoner, and so I attempt to do 100-mile runs, 24-hour runs, 750-mile bike rides, like without stopping. And more often than not, I fail. And when I first started cycling and running, that really bothered me. I was like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this because I'm not succeeding at it. And I realized like the process of attempting this, the courage to do it, the ability to sit with failure and say like, you know what, I didn't have it that day, or I wasn't strong enough that day, or I broke my leg. Like I didn't know that my leg was going to break at mile 52. That's okay. Like sitting with the, that's okay. And having the acceptance of not being good enough in that moment for whatever reason, you know, in your control, out of your control. I think it makes us better people, being failures in parts of our lives, knowing that we're failing in parts of our lives is a good thing. It gives you sort of this healthy limitation on the things that you can, you can't do, you should, you shouldn't do. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try it again another time. But I think that that's a microcosm. Fantasy football trade rejections are a microcosm of that experience, because still every time I get a trade rejection, I get a little like burning sensation in my ears of like, oh no, what did I send? Was it that bad, really? The answer is maybe, but like, who cares? They rejected it. They don't want that deal.
Yeah. And I think what it is as well is just like giving yourself the ability to fail.
Yeah.
Because if you never put yourself out there, you're never going to be in a position to even get that feedback of like, hey, you did great. And it's not always going to be, hey, you did great, you succeeded in your goals or whatever. It's like sometimes, yeah, you're going to break your leg on mile 52, you're going to fall flat on your face, whatever it is. But being just the act of putting yourself out there and going back to this is somewhat how this is seeped into what I was talking about with playing fantasy football of, yeah, I'm expecting 80% of the time this slew of 10 wide receivers, one of them is going to come out and have a good week for me and fall into my best ball lineup. But 20% of the time, that's not going to happen. I said it right there when I said 80% of the time it will work out. And understanding that, hey, I can live with that failure. If that unfortunately happens to me week 16 and I don't make the championship, I played my strategy exactly how I wanted to play it. I did everything that I wanted, and I'm not going to be upset that I did what it was that I set out to do.
How often do your strategies, I'm not talking about like how often do you win championships, but how often do your strategies work the way that you wanted them to?
I would say because for me, playing Dynasty specifically is actually a relatively new thing. Mm. So I didn't start Dynasty until the 2021 season was my first season playing Dynasty. And I have found over time, I have gotten better at being able to predict how the season is going to go for a specific team. So especially in the 2023 timeframe, that was the first season that I really upped my total number of leagues. I think I went up to 15 that year, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly. And that year was a lesson in, hey, I'm trying to do this with all these teams. And for half of them, it just did not work out. Like it was, I didn't have the plan right. I didn't have an understanding of, hey, when this thing goes wrong, what am I going to do? And there's some level of experience now where, hey, I have a plan for the team, and I'm probably up to the point that 75% of the time, that plan is the plan that is the one that I'm hitting there at week 17. But the other 25% of the time, something different has happened. And sometimes it's something different has happened and I'm still able to compete and I'm still trying to be in that championship game week 17. Sometimes it's, as we talked about earlier, man, those two starting quarterbacks, they went down. Well, I'm fully bailing on this year. Yep. And being understanding of, hey, this might not go well. And if it doesn't go well, this is what I'm prepared for. And this is how I'm going to make the best out of the situation that I'm in at that point. And so being able to recognize that I have these other options, that isn't just like it, maybe you can wrap that up as part of the plan. In my head, it's not necessarily part of the plan, but just planning for, hey, something unexpected might happen, and I'll deal with it when that happens, or if that happens, then that's a fine position to be in.
Yeah, I think not having the expectation of 100% success rate, not in the winning, but in the execution of the strategy, maybe deserves more space in fantasy conversations, because the more fringe you get, especially, I think the wilder your strategy, the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong, typically. And then you have to know how to bail yourself out of this tricky situation. You almost have to plan for it. I'm with you. I find that like 80% of the time, my strategies work. Sometimes, you know, Justin Jefferson goes down for 6 weeks and is like, well, I'm kind of screwed here. You know, I can't do anything about that. I made the right profile bet here. But I'm getting boned on this season. That's okay. But sometimes I inject myself too much into my strategies. And I say, like, if this happens, I know I'm going to be able to work through it. And I've found that, like, those situations are typically where it goes sideways for me, to where I don't recognize it soon enough that I'm supposed to be the one bailing it out. And oh no, I've lost 2 weeks and now I'm behind the eight ball. And so I make a move that maybe I wouldn't traditionally make, and I'm floundering a little bit in the strategy and I deviate from it. And those are the times when I've learned the hard lessons like you have, and sort of stayed away from that, or had a little bit more preconception of what it is that I need to do. But anything above, yeah, I think 75, 80%, I think is probably a little bit unrealistic to expect, unless you're playing like directly down the middle in terms of your roster build.
Yeah, I think it's something that I have always heard about fantasy football, is that there's a certain amount of luck. And I've never heard anybody say that that luck percentage is anything less than like 30%.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've heard anywhere from 30% to 50% luck in terms of how you actually get there to the championship. So in terms of what we can do in any kind of strategy, is we can only get to that 50 to 70% influence to begin with. So why not play around a little bit with that and see if you can have that team that, you know, you really enjoy, that is built to some kind of method that's like, hey, I want to try this thing out. And because realistically, your chance of making the championship or winning that championship is so much influenced by some outside factor that just enjoy the ride for what the ride is. Not necessarily, it's kind of, you don't go on the roller coaster in order to get to the end of the roller coaster because that's where it stops. You go on the roller coaster because you like the ups and the downs and the twists and the turns and everything like that. And to me, that's why I play fantasy football. I don't play it to win the championships. I play it because I just want to be along for the ride. I think it's fun to be going through the process, and that's the enjoyment of it.
What's so interesting to me about the sort of the segregation of playoffs and the regular season is, going back to one of your episodes, the weighted consequence of doing really well in the regular season is more impactful than trying to do well in the playoffs. You know, it's almost like beating up on bad teams is more rewarded than doing than trading first in week 14, week 15 to build a super team. And I think that like that's part of the going along for the ride, in my opinion, is don't wait to spend that capital. Don't wait to make the big moves, saying like, well, what happens if, you know, I trade for a running back and they tear up their knee in week 7? Okay, well, if week 1 through 7, you had that running back and they were leading you to the same number of wins you would have expected, or warp you would have expected in the playoffs, they've already cashed in those chips for you because you're ahead and you're more likely to get a bye. And what happens when you get a bye, Koopa? You're twice as likely to win money, right?
Yep. It's better to have gotten a bye than it is just to make playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so why not make those moves earlier in the season? Why not go along for that ride? Don't hold back, because when we get to week 16 and week 17, that's when Jarrett Patterson and Austin Eckler and these players that are, you know, probably not even on some rosters right now, that's when they're going to be relevant. Latavius Murray, those are week 17 plays, not week seven. You need the studs then so you can beat up on people and push them into rebuilds.
Yeah. And I think it's fun to be part of that process. And then also to recognize, hey, this is the process that, you know, it's going to work out one way or another. And as long as I stick to it, like, I'm getting the value out of what is going on as I'm going through this.
Mm-hmm.
And so to kind of move on to the next topic a little bit, but still stick with this somewhat, is we've been talking about this process of building the teams and things like that. What is it that you use in terms of tools, data, things like that, in order to help you come up with what that is going to look like for this team in this league?
It's interesting because for micro decisions, who is good, who is bad, who is better, who is worse, I think there's a lot of value to looking into the underlying metrics, looking at things like snap share, yards per route run, first downs per route run, first read target share, missed tackles forced, like all of that type of stuff you might hear a numbers-based person speak of. Incredibly helpful. Where I think we get lost is everywhere else. Yes, tools can even be helpful for like picking a general direction. But going back to running, have you ever seen those shoes called Hokas? Hoka One One? They have like this crazy thick sole.
Yep.
They were designed for ultra runners, for 100-mile runners. The general concept being like, let's make the bottom of your foot as squishy as possible, because when you're doing these events, you're essentially putting like tons of impact on your legs. And if you don't want to break your leg by doing a 100-mile or 24-hour event, put these pillows on your feet, right? And so they have a very direct application. However, what you see is like mall walkers and moms and overweight dads like myself, like we wear them when we're just like dropping off the kids or going to the grocery store, or, you know, going for a 1 mile jog or playing tennis. And what happens is our feet get used to that. Our arches soften, the calluses fade away. And not only that, but our feet are like intuitively trying to find the ground through these pillows. They're trying to push through all of this cushioning to find stable footing. And so our feet act differently. I think a lot of folks do this sort of with GPSs too, right? Like in your town, you kind of know how to get to the grocery store. You know how to get to school. You know how to get to work. You know how to like get to your favorite restaurants from your house. And then you sort of navigate to places you go to less frequently, right? Well, what happened if you just used your GPS for every single trip you took? You would think less critically about sort of the dynamics of your city. You would understand traffic a little bit worse. You wouldn't think about like, well, if I go here and then there, and then I reroute over to this place to pick up some food, like you don't have that ability to naturally critically think about these different dynamics at play as you're driving. Those are fantasy tools to me. Like, if you have a very specific task, use them. That's great. If you're trying to set a direction, if you're trying to drive from Florida to Washington, you probably need a GPS, right? Like, that's a big directional bet. You don't want to just like pull out the maps like we used to in the 80s. Like, use the tool. But if you're just driving to school, do you really need to turn that thing on again? Are you using it as a crutch in a way that is unhelpful to your lived experience? The same could be said for tools, I think, in fantasy football. Do you need to check a trade calculator every time you send an offer or you receive one? Do you need to like look at everyone's rankings? Do you need to use their biases more than your own? If so, like, why are you playing this? What are you getting out of this? And if you can answer that question like with some intentionality, great, tools are serving their purpose. If you can't, then maybe you need to rethink what tools you're using and why you're using them.
Yeah, we talk about in the South Harmony community, essentially like just blindly using the tools. If you're out there, you're going on Keep Trade Cuts trade calculator, and you need to make sure that every single trade that is sent to you, at the very least, is fair, or you're winning the trade. Like, you can't be on the losing side, then you aren't using it properly. Because you should, no matter what it is, there should be some aspect of your game where, like, hey, the thing I want to do is going to look negative on a certain tool. But I have justification for why this makes sense for me. And you need to be flexible enough that no matter what it is that you're using, that you are able to work around those limitations that some code that somebody has written, some statistic that you're looking at is not going to be able to tell you.
Yeah. We view these things almost as like hammers or circular saws. Like, I can't do the task unless I have a hammer. And that's legitimate in a lot of cases with that specific tool. And I think that that is sort of the perspective of the newer dynasty player. I don't want to tell a newer player to, like, just go with your gut. So my wife, she's going to be embarrassed that I'm saying this. She really likes Najee Harris, and we're in a home league together, right? And the team that has Najee Harris just got adopted yesterday, right? So there's a new manager, and I offered, I think, a 211 for Najee Harris, thinking, like, that should get it done. That's reasonably fair. I don't know what a trade calculator would say. She offered Saquon Barkley. Like, not in the same universe. She should have used a trade calculator, because she knows now that, like, that's an absurd trade offer. And that manager declined and said, surely you could not have meant to send this trade offer. Like, they did the kind thing, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, a new dynasty player, yeah, use the tools, right? Once you get past the sort of absurd Saquon Barkley for Najee Harris deals, then start to use your intuition.
For sure. There's one other thing that I wanted to ask you about, and it is touching on that orphan team thing. Mm-hmm. Of, you have always played of taking over orphans, never doing a single startup until mm-hmm. this past offseason.
Yeah.
How did you get into doing that and staying entirely away from the startup space?
I didn't know that other people didn't do that. I'll start there. I thought it was just like a normal thing. There's a bunch of orphans available. Let me go take one. I really enjoyed the experience of figuring people out before they knew me, because I was coming from a place of not having the savvy of a veteran dynasty manager. And so I made it important the first year to not make big moves, deviating from norms, but more importantly, to understand what my league mates were trying to accomplish and how they were doing those things, how they were screwing up, right? And so I took notes like Leo Pasiga recommended. I built spreadsheets. And what I did was I took transactions of, I mean, I took like a million transactions 1 year, and I was analyzing them against my league mates to try to predict what they would be doing based on what other people had done who were employing similar strategies. And guess what? It worked, man. Like, I was starting to figure these people out, and I realized, like, oh, I'm a chameleon. That's what I need to do. I need to use these strategies that other people aren't talking about, they're not using, they're not even seeing in a lot of ways. That's who I am. That's what I'm good at. I'm not good at the rest of this dynasty game. I don't know how to draft rookies. I don't know this and that, but I know this little niche part of the game. And so one team turned into three, turned into 11 to 18 to, I don't know, I'm in like 40 or something right now. That's how it starts, is like finding something that you are better than the market at and leveraging it over and over and over again against people. It doesn't have to be orphans. I think that it's a difficult task in hindsight. I probably should have just done what everyone else does and draft my own teams. But now that, like, I'm pretty good at it, like, I don't see why I need to do startups. I'm equally, if not more efficient, taking on these shitty teams because I have information that other people don't.
Yeah, it's the first time I heard that from you, that you only took over orphans, I was like, is this man insane? Like, what is going on here? Like, I'm like, how can you take over, like... And I was also thinking, how do you take over teams? Because you have to turn every single one of them into a team that you like. Like, that just sounds like so much work.
Oh, I trade so much. Yeah. And this is not a charity thing. Y'all, like, I've made like tens of thousands of dollars doing this. It's a profitable undertaking if you do it right. If you do any component of fantasy football right, you can make a lot of money. This is one of them. Like, people shit on it, but it's a profitable thing to do, to take on other people's bad teams.
Mm-hmm. Especially if something I've found in a couple instances is the league mates won't take you as seriously.
Yeah.
Because the previous manager, like, let's say they screwed up the team, and because they were not a good manager, you take over that team and they'll see your roster and forget that, you know, you took over the team. You weren't the one that drove it to that point. And you'll get some interesting results out of that.
I don't change the team name typically. I'll just keep it whatever it was. I kind of want to float under the radar. I'm cool with that. Think I'm an idiot, especially if I'm not doing a mainstream strategy. You know, if my goals are different than yours and I have this really oddball looking team, they don't notice it before it's too late that, oh shit, Tommy already has four elite quarterbacks. Like, what is he doing? Why doesn't he have any wide receivers? Okay, he drafted all fourth round running back. Like, and before you know it, the roster construction looks totally different, right? And then you just start to feed into the right bets, these little bets over and over again. And the next year, you've got a great team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so we've been talking now for a little bit over an hour. So we're going to get towards the end here. What I want to do is give you the floor for 1 minute. Rant on anything, whether it's life, whether it's fantasy, whatever that thing is that you're like, I just need somebody to know about this, so that way it's off my chest, or they can learn from it, or whatever that is.
Yeah. Is my timer going now?
We'll start it right now.
All right. So I was riding my bike the other day, and someone told me that physics were against my bicycle. And they had no clue that, A, that they were wrong. But the thing that stuck with me was that they felt so empowered to tell me that I was wrong when I was intentionally doing something different. This is it looks like a suspension bridge. It's got, you know, all these different features, but it's a bike that I'm going to ride for 750 miles nonstop. It's also set the land speed record, like the same exact model set the land speed record for all bicycles in human history. It's the fact that different equals bad in a lot of people's minds. And I think that it translates directly into fantasy football. I think it translates into a lot of different aspects of our life, especially today in 2025. I think that folks need to stop looking at different and assume that it's worse than the mainstream. You know, let's just embrace differences for what they are, which is intentional choices. And we should live with that. We should accept that other people aren't us.
Yeah, I think that's... That goes right back to everything we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Be comfortable with being different than everyone else, doing what it is that is applies to you and not what applies to your league mates. And yeah. I think that's a perfect note to wrap it up on. So,
man, thank you so much for having me on. I want to say it
thank
again.
You.
I love your show, man. What you're doing is really cool. It's different. And it deserves so much more of a platform than what you get. Like, you should be up there with the Matthew Berrys of the world, with the work that you do.
Well, thank you. Once again, tell everyone where it is that they can go and find you at.
Yeah, find me with the Superflex Dude over on the Superflex Super Show, one of the DLF podcasts. I'm over on Blue Sky as well. Unfortunately, not on Twitter. Sorry, y'all. At FF Tommy B, though, over at Blue Sky.
For sure. And as always, check me out at Dynasty Koopa on Twitter, at Koopa Troopa 8, everywhere else. And as always, stay sharp and keep grinding that edge. I'll see you next week.